From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lies, lies, you're telling me that you'll be true. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our 60s music retrospective with garage bands and one-hit wonders. We talk with Lenny Kaye, who produced the garage band anthology Nuggets. He's also Patti Smith's longtime guitarist. Nancy Sinatra tells us how she created the image of the tough girl with her hit These Boots Are Made for Walkin', and then recorded a duet with her father that put them at the top of the charts. And we play back an interview about Bobby Darin with his record producer and good friend, the late Nick Vinay. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. You think that you're such a smart girl, and I'll believe what you say. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Vice President Dick Cheney kept up his campaign to win public support for a preemptive strike against Iraq today, despite opposition from U.S. allies in Europe and the Middle East. Cheney told a Korean War veterans group in Texas that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein posed a mortal danger to the United States. The vice president added, however, that the administration is willing to consult with Congress.
He welcomes the debate that has been joined here at home, and he has made it clear to his national security team that he wants us to participate fully in the hearings that will be held in Congress next month on this vitally important issue.
French President Jacques Chirac said today that France opposes any unilateral military action by the United States and that any military action against Iraq would have to be approved by the UN Security Council. A draft United Nations report says al-Qaeda is still a significant threat to the international community. The report says the terrorist network still has access to money and weapons, and its ability to fund other activities has increased. The BBC's Greg Barrow reports from the UN.
This new report from the United Nations is a chilling read for anyone who thought that the al-Qaeda organization had collapsed with the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan last year. According to a leaked copy of the UN report, al-Qaeda is fit and well and poised to strike again at its leisure. The UN report casts a critical eye over the world's reaction to the threat from al-Qaeda after the attacks on the United States almost a year ago. It says that while efforts to block the financing of the organization were relatively successful in the immediate aftermath of the September the 11th attacks, banks have become less and less enthusiastic about freezing accounts allegedly belonging to al-Qaeda members.
The BBC's Greg Barrow. The Bush administration has backed away from a plan to bar foreign aircraft over the September 11th crash sites during the coming anniversary. NPR's Jason Beaubien reports.
The proposed flight restrictions were being pushed by officials at the Pentagon. The rules would have banned international air carriers from flying over New York City, Washington, D.C., and Somerset, Pennsylvania for parts of September 11th and 12th. Representatives of foreign airlines denounced the proposal as discriminatory and said it created the impression that foreign carriers are less safe than American ones. The White House abandoned the plan on the grounds that it might not be legal to bar international but not domestic carriers. An administration official says the Federal Aviation Administration flight rules for the September 11th anniversary are still being crafted, but they'll treat foreign and domestic airlines the same. Those regulations are expected to place the greatest restrictions on charter and private planes. Jason Beaubien, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 23 points to close at 8,670 in active trading. This is NPR News. At this hour, baseball players and owners are trying to resolve their labor differences in order to avoid a players' strike scheduled for tomorrow. The latest news out of New York is that negotiators have hit a snag in contract talks. Still, many are optimistic the two sides can reach a deal before Friday's deadline. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
Players and owners reportedly are having trouble resolving their differences over the levels of a luxury tax on teams with the highest payrolls. But those close to the talks say the possible snag could represent the kind of last-minute ups and downs that happen in the final hours of contract negotiations. The mood surrounding the talks generally has been positive. After several Wednesday meetings with the union, baseball's chief operating officer Bob Dupay said, quote, "I'm optimistic we'll get a deal done Thursday." Players and owners agree that taxing the highest highest spending teams and sharing team revenues could help restore competitive balance to baseball. The two sides are trying to come together on the amounts of tax and revenue. They'll have to do it without the help of the Bush administration. A spokesman said today the White House will not get involved in the labor dispute. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
A judge in Norwalk, Connecticut has sentenced Michael Skakel to 20 years in prison for a murder committed in 1975. Skakel, a nephew of Ethel Kennedy, was convicted in June of murdering Martha Moxley when they were 15-year-old neighbors in a wealthy suburb. Much of the prosecution's case was based on testimony from witnesses who said they heard Skakel confess to the crime or make incriminating statements over the years. At the sentencing, Skakel wept and maintained that he's innocent. In stocks today, the Nasdaq gained 21 points, or 1.6%, to close at 1335. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's 60s Music Week on Fresh Air. We start today's edition with Nancy Sinatra, Frank's daughter. Their duet record, Something Stupid, was a number one Billboard hit for 4 weeks in 1967. That was 3 weeks longer than Frank's other number one hit of the 60s, Strangers in the Night. Nancy had her first hit in early 1966 with These Boots Are Made for Walking, which put across a pretty tough image, but her earlier records were bubblegum productions overseen by Annette Funicello's music director. They did okay overseas, but they bombed in the States. In fact, Nancy Sinatra's label, Reprise, was getting ready to dump her, even though the label was founded by her father. Reprise was willing to give her one more chance in 1965, and with some help, she changed her image and her luck. In 1996, she told me how she did it.
Jimmy Bowen, who was head of A&R at Reprise, put me with a guy named Lee Hazelwood. Lee had approached Jimmy, unbeknownst to me. He said, I can get her a chart record in this country, and if I don't get her a chart record in this country, you can tell me to leave. And he said, I promise a chart record the first time out. And he delivered. It was called So Long, Babe, and it barely made the charts, but it made the charts. During that session, he said to me, you can't sing like Nancy Nicelady anymore. You have to sing for the truckers. At about this time, I was getting a divorce. My husband decided he didn't want to have children, and I did, and he knew it. So we split. And Lee said to me, you've been married, and now you're divorced, and people know that. So let's lose this virgin image. Let's get rid of it. And we did that, and we lowered the key. We dropped my voice down where it belonged. Again, where I was more comfortable early on in the more R&B type things.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin', and now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Yeah. You keep lying when you ought to be truthing, and you keep losing when you ought to not bet. You keep saying when you ought to be a-changing. Now what's right is right, but you ain't been right yet. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
Did your whole image change after this record came out, the way you dressed, what your public persona?
You know, again, timing is everything in life. I had been on tour in Europe. I brought home from Carnaby Street the miniskirt. And I wasn't crazy about the way my legs looked in the miniskirt, so I put on a pair of boots. I wore that around. It became my favorite thing to wear. I wore it to the dance clubs that I went to.
I messed up you right here. Were they white boots?
No, no, they weren't. Actually, they were kind of a camely brown color.
Now, a little later on, you recorded a duet with your father, Something Stupid. One thing that's always interested me about this record is that it's a song sung from the perspective of two lovers, but you were singing it as father and daughter. Was that a slightly awkward thing to do?
No, it was a very natural thing to do, but the disc jockeys dubbed it the incest song.
Oh, really?
At the time, which I think probably added to it in a way. You know, it gave them something fun to kid about. Now recording it, there are different ways to love people, I think, you know.
Was it daunting to record a duet with your father, or were you relaxed about it?
I was very relaxed about it. I had a certain number of hits of my own, and the scary part, though, was coming in when at the end of the session that they were doing that night with Jobim.
Oh, that's the date you recorded with Antonio Carlos Jobim.
Mm-hmm. It was one of the sessions for that album, the first of their albums.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, coming in with my little, I called us the B team. Coming in with the B team and watching the A team in action, I was just, it was enthralling. And I don't like this word, but awesome, you know. And then, of course, the A-team moved over, and the little B-team took over, Lee Hazelwood, Jimmy Bowen, Billy Strange, and our rhythm section. And we cut a number one song.
Yeah, you delivered.
Yeah.
I know I stand in line until you think you have the time to spend an evening with me. And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me. Then afterwards we drop into a quiet little place and have a drink or two. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you. I can see it in your eyes that you...
Our interview with Nancy Sinatra was recorded in 1996. In the mid-60s, in between the start of the British invasion and the domination of progressive rock, teenagers around America were starting bands, rehearsing in their parents' garages, imitating the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Kinks, Bob Dylan, and other hitmakers of the day. Some of those bands went into the studio and made one great record. In 1972, Lenny Kaye collected some of those one-hit wonders and some of the great but obscure singles of the period on an anthology called Nuggets. Nuggets included this record by the Standells, which made it to number 11 in 1966, the same year Nancy Sinatra had her first hit.
I'm gonna tell you a story.
Lenny Kaye's anthology Nuggets is now considered one of the most important and influential documents of 60s garage rock. Lenny Kaye went on to become Patti Smith's guitarist. He co-produced an expanded version of Nuggets for Rhino Records in 1998. I talked with him about Nuggets when the expanded version was released. Lenny Kaye, welcome to Fresh Air.
Pleasure to be here.
I want to start by asking you to choose a record from the original Nuggets that pretty well defines what the project is all about, a record you still love.
Well, when Joey Ramone had a birthday party at Coney Island High a couple months ago, I strapped on Pushing Too Hard by the Seeds, and I realized it was the first time I played it ever, and it is quite a rockin' song and seems to me to be the very definition of what a garage band should be.
The first time you played it, you mean the first time you performed it?
That's the first time I ever sang it from start to finish, and it's not as easy as it seems, I
must
say.
Oh, why not?
The guitar break has a certain elemental simplicity, but it kind of moves around in a nice way. And we also amped it up a little bit, so it had a kind of 90s velocity to it. But it's a really great song. It's got two whole chords, and it's got the kind of a spit-out lyrics that, you know, to me really define what was happening in rock and roll in the mid-60s here in America.
Okay, and this is Pushing Too Hard, The Seeds from Nuggets.
Pushing too hard, you're pushing on me. You're pushing too hard at what you want me to be. You're pushing too hard about the things you say. You're pushing too hard every night and day. You're pushing too hard, pushing too hard on me. Well, all I want is to just be free, live my life the way I wanna be. All I want is to just have fun.
It's Pushing Too Hard from 1966, one of the recordings included on the original anthology Nuggets, produced by my guest, Lenny Kaye. Lenny Kaye, what's the story behind how Nuggets was first produced?
Well, I was introduced to Jack Holzman, who was the president of Elektra Records, around the end of 1970. I had been chosen, for reasons that escaped me, to be one of the heavy hundred of rock and roll in Esquire magazine. I was their token rock critic. I think it was because I'd written a favorable review of the Stooges' first album. And Jack Holzman called me up. He was a very literate record company president and liked the input of the press and also did groups that had a certain intellectual edge, like The Doors and Love, the MC5 and the Stooges. And he asked me to be a kind of A&R freelance scout at the time. In the end, none of the groups that I brought him, he really was interested in, and vice versa. But one of the projects he had, and I think it was because he just gotten one of the first cassette machines, was he wanted to do an album called Nuggets, which consisted of those tracks from albums that only had one good track. I think his idea was to clean out his record collection. And he passed it over to me, and I kind of spun it toward the kind of teen bands that I grew up listening to as a wild animal in New Jersey with my own teen band.
So what qualified a record for inclusion on the original Nuggets?
In the original Nuggets, it was mostly if I liked it. And my thing for inclusion was that it had to be a really great song that was not quite a major hit, nor a complete collector obscurity. I was very conscious of making a listening album. My models were, on the one hand, the more academic hand, the Yazoo Blues collections, Blues of Southwest Georgia, 1928 to 32, you know, very scholarly, you know. And on the other hand, when I was a kid, I used to get these Mr. Maestro oldies compilations, you know, 20 original hits, you know, a guy with a motorcycle and some wild babe riding next to him, and, you know, kind of just a bunch of great songs. And so my thought was that, you know, to make a record that was really fun to listen to of these records that were not that easy to get a hold of, or that you had to dig them off records that, the group had vanished in the haze. It was only as the retrospect, you know, as the hindsight grew, that I began to see just how much of a genre I was mining. I think as the years passed, the sense of what a garage band is, you know, that sense of punk rock as it's kind of a borning, you know, became clearer, not only to me, but to the people who heard Nuggets and kind of made it a touchstone for a type of music.
My guest is Lenny Kaye, producer of the garage band anthology Nuggets. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1998 interview with Lenny Kaye about Nuggets, his now classic anthology of garage bands and one-hit wonders of the 60s. Let's listen to another track from the original volume of Nuggets. And this is from the group Count Five. It's called Psychotic Reaction. And this got some radio play. I think people who were listening to radio at the time will know this. Tell me what you think this song represents within the collection.
I think one of the major influences on these bands was the British invasion. Possibly because before then, most bands with guitars were kind of either surf bands, very instrumental-oriented, or a little bit more like, say, Johnny and the Hurricanes. Again, very instrumental. And seeing a group like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones on Ed Sullivan inspired all these bands to kind of want to be like them. Of all the English bands, I think the most influential on the garage bands were the Yardbirds, because they seemed to push the envelope of sound sonically so much further. They had incredible guitar players, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton early on, and that fuzz-tony sound that the Yardbirds had in a song like Over Under Sideways Down or I'm a Man really turned musicians on in America. You know, again, you're seeing a whole new palette of sound. The Count Five were from San Jose in California, and they really got that Yardbird sound and had a fairly large hit on it. I certainly might not have been in the top 10, but it grazed there. And, you know, that's about all you need to become a rock and roll star for your moment in time.
Okay, here's the Count Five, Psychotic Reaction. Psychotic Reaction, the Count Five, from the original volume of Nuggets produced by my guest, Lenny Kaye. There's three new volumes that have been added to that in the new Rhino Nuggets box set. Listening back to the Nuggets recordings, what would you say were the most influential records on the bands included in Nuggets?
I would say, things like The Shadows of Night, The Blues Project.
Question mark and the Mysterians. Don't you think that 96 Tears and its organ line is one of the most influential things?
Yes, but you know, it's not on the current Nuggets because that song is just impossible to license.
Don't you think 96 Tears, though, influenced a lot of the bands on Nuggets?
I think 96 Tears influenced them. I think, in a sense, they influenced each other. It's hard to pick out one track because it was like a cauldron at the time, and it was spread out across America. I mean, you know, you had, like, in every small town in America, bands that were getting together and learning how to play their instruments and suddenly, seizing the tail of the tiger. I think that all of them partook of a certain sound and that their time was almost, in a way, limited because the music was changing so quickly. It would, by the end of the 60s, have a whole different feel. Amplifier technology was moving so quickly that, in a sense, the Nuggets bands would sound, their textures would sound differently. People would move from a Farfisa organ, this little toy organ almost, to the big sound of the Hammond. It was kind of, they were caught. I always think of it as, you know, and around 1964, all these bands left one side of the river, and then they're kind of in the middle of the river, and they're being tossed by the currents and everything. When they get to the other side, rock and roll has changed. But I like that middle time when people are kind of a little bit not sure of where they're going and what they're doing with it, and they're just trying to, they're experimenting. It's very unpredictable music within its kind of genre.
Lenny Kaye recorded in 1998 after the expanded version of his anthology Nuggets was released. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the State of Vermont, linking midweek travelers with the annual fall colors of Vermont. Online travel planner at vermontvacation.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the music of Bobby Darin. We listen back to a conversation with the late Nick Vinay. He was Darin's close friend and producer.
I'm not the guy who cared about love, and I'm not the guy who cared about fortunes and such. I never cared much, but look at me now. And I never knew technique of kissing. I never knew the thrill I could get from your touch. Never knew much, oh, look at me now. I'm a new man, better than Casanova at his best, with a new heart, brand new start. I'm so proud I'm busting my vest. So I'm the guy who turned out a lover,
So I'm the guy who laughed at those blue diamond rings. One of those things, oh, look at me now.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's 60s Music Week on Fresh Air.
Splish splash, I was taking a bath, long about a Saturday night. Yeah, rubbed up, just relaxing in the tub, thinking everything was all right. When I stepped out the tub, put my feet on the floor.
Bobby Darin's first hit was the novelty record Splish Splash, but he went on to become one of the most sophisticated and jazz-inspired pop stars of the 60s. You can hear the strong Sinatra influence in his later singing and in the arrangements behind him. Darin's hits of the 60s included Dream Lover, Mac the Knife, Beyond the Sea, and If I Were a Carpenter. Darin died in 1973, at the age of 37, of a heart condition. Nick Vinay was one of Darin's closest friends and musical collaborators. They met as teenagers when they were first trying to make it in the music business. Vinay produced many of Darin's records. The list of other performers Vinay discovered and or produced includes the Beach Boys, Linda Ronstadt, Ricky Nelson, Gene Vincent, Glenn Campbell, and Sam Cooke. Nick Vinay died in 1998. 2 years earlier, I spoke with him about Darin after Vinay had produced a Bobby Darin box set. It included the demo of Darin's hit Dream Lover. Before we play it, let's hear the story behind the demo.
Well, he felt that if the song didn't make it with people, if they really didn't get the message with just him and a guitar. By the way, the guitarist is Fred Neil. In that period of time, everything was cute and pretty. And he wanted to do something that was not cute, not pretty, but worked on another level. And he tried it with just the guitar to see how it would affect people. And it affected everyone. And he knew he had a song that would possibly transcend a certain amount of time. And he made the demo at the session with just Fred playing the guitar. And then later on, everybody asked him to add more, and he did, and he went on. And, of course, it was a hit. Either version will make it for me, too. But that version's real special because it's just Bobby and the guitar, and he sings it as well as he sang anything else.
Well, let's hear the previously unreleased demo version of Dream Lover, written and sung by Bobby Darin and featured on the new Bobby Darin box set.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. 'Cause I need a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true, and the hand that I can hold and feel you near as I grow old. 'Cause I need a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
That's Bobby Darin's 1959 demo of his song Dream Lover. My guest Nick Vinay co-produced the new Bobby Darin box set when was Bobby Darin's longtime friend and sometime producer. How did you meet Bobby Darin?
We were both in our teens, I guess, and we were working at the Brill Building in New York. The Brill Building was the music mecca of pop music, I guess, at that time. And it was centrally located, and we met a lot of people, like Burt Bacharach had an office there, Lee Bernstolar had an office there, and Darin and I rented a broom closet and converted it into an office. And we just wanted a place to put our names on the door. And he wrote songs, and I tried to put records together. The word producer was not being used at that time. And we actually met in the elevator at the Brill Building and several times, and we ate in the same restaurant around the corner. And we just became friends, and a group of us, really. And we started hanging out and using the broom closet as a place to meet. And we kept a piano in there and a place to write and play demos.
What were his aspirations then, and what were yours?
Mine was, except the word producer wasn't, was to direct records and create records. And Darren always wanted to be nothing other than a songwriter and sometimes performer. And songwriting was his main goal at that time. I think that's because being a star or a hit artist probably was too much of a fantasy. Sometimes you have a dream that's too heavy to carry. But being a songwriter was more realistic. And he wanted to be a songwriter. That was very important to him.
How much faith did he have in his singing?
He had more faith in his songwriting than his singing. But as the first couple records he made, of course, you know, did not sell very well. They were bombs. But as he progressed, he felt stronger about his singing. And at some point he decided that he's going to have to do it with his songs because he just felt that he had the interpretation he couldn't give to other people when he just wrote them.
Although he started off with rock and roll hits, he seemed to know early on that he wanted to sing standards and probably end up in Vegas. Now, a lot of rock and rollers in the late 50s and early 60s were groomed to play Vegas, but often against their will. But the feeling was rock and roll is a fad, and unless you learn how to play Vegas, you'll be out of a career by the time you're in your 20s.
Correct.
You know, go ahead.
That particular time period, you know, we were still coming out of the late 40s. The influence in the 50s was from the adults in the late 40s. And singing was legit singing, and you had to play in a club, and you had to play Vegas and those venues, or you weren't a success. And if you didn't learn to play those places, you would end up doing one-nighters with 20 other acts that had one hit on various disc jockey shows in small towns. And a lot of the rock and rollers could not do the pop situation, and a lot of them could. And the transition was tough for some. There was Paul Anka who made the transition. And it was very few of them, really. And Darren made the great transition.
We're listening to a 1996 interview with the late Nick Vinay, who was Bobby Darin's close friend and producer. We'll continue the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold.
Let's get back to our interview about Bobby Darin with his close friend and producer, Nick Vinay. The interview was recorded in 1996, 2 years before Vinay's death. When we spoke, Vinay had just co-produced a Bobby Darin box set. For a lot of people in rock and roll, listeners and performers, Vegas symbolized everything that was square and unsavory about show business. Why did Bobby Darin want that?
Well, Darin thought that he could actually bridge the gap and bring his audience, and the word teenagers is the word they used, people under the age of 25, he could actually bring them up to where they, too, would appreciate Sinatra. They'd appreciate Tony Bennett. They'd appreciate pop music. And he tried to cross it. He tried to keep the rhythm and the tempo for dancing situations and for the excitement. And later on, when you get into Mac the Knife, you'll see he did it.
Well, we should hear Mac the Knife. Now, he recorded this when he was 23. And I know when I heard it when I was young, it was catchy. I don't know. And then in college, I was introduced to the three-penny opera, and I thought, boy, that Bobby Darin, he really ruined Mac the Knife. He made it into a showbiz anthem. How horrible of him. And when I listen to it now, I think, what a great recording. What incredible rhythm he has in this. I mean, he transforms the song, but yes. He does something really interesting with it.
And I must tell you, that's his concept. It was his idea, and everyone thought he had lost it.
That he was crazy?
He was crazy. They thought they just couldn't believe that he was going to do that, and he did.
Well, why did he choose this song? What did he hear in it? What did he hear in it to swing it? I mean, it's not a song that you think of swinging.
Well, we're dealing with a guy that could go back to the 20s. He knew Frank Tashmatter and Johnny Dodds and the early Dixieland musicians. He was steeped in the music business history and various forms of music. And he loved, personally, Dixieland. Had he had his druthers, born 20 years earlier, he would have been a Dixieland, he would have had a Dixieland band. And what he did is he loved these tunes, Kurt Weill tunes. He just loved them because they were German umpa tunes, you know. They were kind of done in that old style for the show, of course. And he just loved the whole theory, the way the song was written, the mysterious lyrics, you know, their various levels. He thought he could get away with it, and he did. He was just brilliant.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie Heath, babe, so there's never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk, ooh, Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. Eek! And someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know, where a cement bag just drooping on down. Oh, that cement is just, it's there for the weight, dear. Five will get you 10, old Mackey's back in town. Don't you hear about Louis Miller? He disappeared, babe, after drawing out.
What did the success of Mac the Knife prove, and how did it change his career?
Surprisingly, it didn't change his personality. But what it did change is his thinking. He realized that he had that thing that artists get when they get into the center. They know that their creative ideas are right if they just don't let outside people talk them out of it. And they use their gut feelings. And then he started using his own feelings for picking types of songs and making albums. And it worked. He just avoided talking to too many people because they all had ideas of what was wrong with it. He just wanted to know what was right with it. And so that really gave him the that feeling that he's right and he's an artist and he can come up with great ideas if he keeps them intact.
Now, he was supposed to record Donkashane after
Yes,
Mac
he was.
The Knife. But instead he gave the song to Wayne Newton, and of course the rest is history.
Darren was producing Wayne. Darren had signed Wayne Newton. Wayne was brought to Bobby by Dick Clark, believe it or not, in New York. And we went down to see him playing in a lounge, and he was just terrific. And Bobby signed him as his first act on his Capitol production deal. Bobby was banking for the future. He wanted to produce, and he wanted to publish, and he wanted to run a record company and slowly over the years taper off from performing, which at that time was becoming more difficult for him physically. And he just didn't want to make it public, so he started getting more involved in production. As you know, Darren didn't have a lot of years.
Well, I'm going to skip playing Wayne Newton's Donkashane because I want to save as much time as we can to play Bobby Darin's music.
Cut that part out, but I don't blame you.
So how did Bobby Darin actually make it to Vegas?
Well, Steve Blauner, his manager, introduced him to George Burns. And George Burns just, you got to understand, Darren, when he walked in the room, he had that presence, that great spirit. Very few people have it, but when they have it, you know it. They walk in a room and everybody stops. They may not be facing the door, but they stop. And George Burns met Darren, and he just felt that thing that Darren had, that this kid is going to be a star. And Darren had already had a couple of records on the charts. And Blauner told Burns that if you take him to Vegas, you won't be disappointed. And he did. And Darren just lit up Vegas. You know, he was one of the highest paid performers ever in his 20s in Las
Vegas. Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he packed it in. Darren was truly a phenomenon in Las Vegas. It was unbelievable.
Were you in Vegas, too, at that time?
Oh, we used to go up there all the time. Remember, we're two kids, two poor kids from the city. I'm from Baltimore, and he's from New York. And this was dog heaven for us. We were raised that you're successful. You drive Cadillacs. You wear a gold link bracelet on your left hand to tell you who you are. And you wear one on your right hand to tell you who you were. And we did it all. We were foolish like that, but it was worth it. And Vegas to us was just the cat's meow. I can't tell you. We didn't even think it was gaudy. We thought it was neat. We were in our 20s, you know. And it was very exciting because we came from very good people, but very simple neighborhoods.
Did Vegas change Bobby Darin's personality, and did success change him?
Success never changed Darin. Vegas never changed Darin. Politics changed Darin. That's what changed Bobby Darin. His political awareness and growth, and his involvement in politics. He went from being a kid raised in the center to a kid that practically became a bomb-throwing leftist politically, and meeting the Kennedys also altered his life. And it altered his ability to play Vegas under certain conditions. Number one, he wanted Vegas to integrate more. He wanted to see more black Americans working at the tables, working in the orchestras, working at the various other jobs, other than the jobs where you didn't see anyone, those faceless jobs in the back. And he became a civil rights worker, quietly.
Did this political awakening lead to the folk part of his career?
Yes. He wanted to stay with the audience that started with him, and he wanted to make the transition with them. For instance, it was okay for you and I to, I don't know how old you are, so I don't know if you were there. He wanted, if I could take and start wearing Levi's and letting my hair grow long, and started campaigning for Kennedy, he thought he could do that too, and he didn't understand why people would say he's trying to become a folky. They didn't say Dylan's trying to become a folky. They didn't say I was becoming a folk producer.
But they thought it was phony that somebody with a Vegas pedigree at this point was growing their hair long and singing folk songs.
And it's an interesting thing. He was willing to lose half his audience for his political conviction. But there was a point there when he lost almost all his audience because one group didn't like him going that far to the left, and the other group on the left didn't want him coming over because they didn't trust him. He was in between a rock and a hard place.
Let me actually play one of his folk songs, one of the songs that he wrote and that he used to close his show with, and it's called Simple Song of Freedom. Now, we're going to hear a demo version of it, I believe previously unreleased, that's featured on this box set. And you were there when he recorded the demo. In fact, I think the tape machine was on your lap.
Yes.
Tell us about this.
Darin had been working on the song, and what he wanted to write was This Land Is Your Land. He wanted to write a song that people could take with them, they could sing with them. And he worked very hard to simplify this. And it's a statement of the time. I get very emotional when I think of it. But he finished it that morning, and he put it on the tape recorder. I held the tape recorder on my lap. and held the mic up. And that was the final version. In fact, there's a mistake in it, but he kept going. And he said, "That's my anthem." And he closed his shows forever after that with that song.
Why don't we pause here and listen to Bobby Darin's demo of his song, Simple Song of Freedom.
Come and sing a simple song of freedom. Sing it like you've never sung before. Let it fill the air, tell the people everywhere that we the people here don't want a war. Hey there, Mr. Black Man, can you hear me? I won't dig your diamonds or hunt your game. I just want to be someone known to you as me. And I will bet my life you want the same. So come and sing a simple song of freedom.
You know, this the song that we heard, the demo of Simple Song of Freedom, his actual studio version of that wasn't released until after his death.
Yes, yes.
And there's, yeah, go ahead.
No, it's just that there were a lot of things on tape that weren't released during his lifetime. He just felt sometimes he wasn't ready to release it, and he had so much he wanted to do, he was afraid to release a lot of things. It might hurt his schedule. And he was a man racing against time, I promise you.
We're listening to a 1996 interview with the late Nick Vinay, who was Bobby Darin's close friend and producer. We'll continue the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Living for you is easy living. It's easy to live when you're in love, and I'm so in love. There's nothing in life but you. I never regret the years I'm given.
It's 60s Music Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview about Bobby Darin with his close friend and producer, Nick Vinay. The interview was recorded in 1996, 2 years before Vinay's death. When we spoke, Vinay had just co-produced a Bobby Darin box set. He died of a heart condition. How long was he aware that he had a heart condition? Did he always know that?
Yes, he did. He knew that from when he was a small kid, when he was in his when he was 8 or 9 years old, he understood that. He also understood he wasn't going to make it to 21. And then then the new diagnosis said 30. We're the exact age, and he passed away at 36, 37. He outlived the sentences they gave him of how long he was going to live. But he also knew that he had pressed his luck. We did a lot of gambling. We loved Las Vegas. And he used to say, "I'm playing it like it lays." Towards the end there, he used to say, "Boy, I'm pressing my luck, but I'm going to double up." And that was his phrase all the time. He said, "We'll go in the studio. I'm going to double up and see if I can do an album while I still have the energy." He was wearing down towards the end.
You co-produced the new box set of Bobby Darin's work, which is divided into his rock work, his pop work, and his folk and country. What was it like for you to sit down and listen back to all of this?
It was tough. It was tough. The mistakes were bigger. The best parts were better. And it's always tough going back. Darin, we shared a lot of philosophy. I know that Darin never grew old, not because he died young. If he was alive today, he still would not be old. Darin was not an old person. He'd never, he would have, He was young. He would have been young now. And going back over these things, you see the amount of time and years and the places. It's very difficult to do a box set. I've worked with other box sets on people I've worked with, but this one was the toughest because we had put so much time and space between all the songs. We were everywhere: New York, Nashville, Chicago, L.A., Las Vegas, Miami. It was one of those times when this country was on the move. TV was not the king that it is today, nor the glass breast it is today, and there was more entertainment out there.
I'd like to close with a song, and I'm going to let you pick this one. I'd like you to pick and to introduce a song that you particularly love or that has special significance for you.
I'd like to play Beyond the Sea.
And why do you want to choose this?
Darren would go up to Pfeiffer Beach all the time and Big Sur. And that's where he did his best thinking towards the end. And he would whistle Beyond the Sea on the beach. And I'd walk, a quarter of a mile behind him, because he wanted me to see how the sound sounded when the wind brought it back. He was still planning on recording a new version of Beyond the Sea at Pfeiffer Beach. It just means a lot.
Nick Vinay, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing. Somewhere beyond the sea, she's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing. It's far beyond a star, it's near beyond the moon. I know beyond a doubt, shore, we'll kiss just as before. Happy we'll be beyond the sea, and never again I'll go sailing.
Our interview with Nick Vinay was recorded in 1996 after the release of a Bobby Darin box set. Vinay died of cancer in 1998 at the age of 61. Our 60s music series continues tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Kissing in Manhattan, fiction about love-hungry urbanites by David Schickler, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we continue our 60s music week with the psychedelic era. We'll play back interviews with the late rock promoter Bill Graham, the late John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas, and Neil Young. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Oh.